Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Tuesday, March 26, 2024. I'm your reader, Kathleen. The headline of the top article in today's Gazette, UNI waiving time restrictions for grad students seeking to return. This story is by Vanessa Miller. Before COVID curbed enrollment, hitting the University of Northern Iowa especially hard with a nearly 10% drop in total students and 20% drop in its graduate and professional count, the last time UNI reported a grad school cohort under 1,300 was 1993. But the pandemic accelerated what had become a UNI slide in graduate enrollment from a high of 1,902 in 2017 to 1,218 in 2020, the lowest tally in three decades. Our work ahead will focus on growing enrollment while continuing progress in areas consistent with our mission and strategic plan, UNI shared with the Board of Regents in its 2020 enrollment report. 4 years later, UNI is in the throes of that endeavor, boasting modest progress by pulling up its graduate and professional enrollment to 1,279 and rolling out initiatives geared toward creating momentum both at the student and faculty level. Life can present unexpected challenges, UNI recently acknowledged in announcing a special opportunity for students who have taken a break from pursuing their graduate degree. The opportunity is a waiver from UNI's recency requirements, which for decades have blocked UNI graduate students who left without getting a degree from restarting again after a gap of 7 years for master's students and 10 years for doctoral students. Per UNI's existing rules, courses taken more than 7 years or 10 years for doctoral programs prior to the granting of the degree cannot be used to meet degree requirements. But the UNI offer lifts that barrier, allowing former graduate students admitted in 2011 or later to seamlessly pick up right where they left off in their academic journey, or even try something new. Our goal is to create a flexible, supportive environment for UNI students who wish to continue their work toward a master's or doctoral degree after a temporary break, said Stephanie Huffman, Associate Vice President for Strategic Initiatives and Dean of the College of Graduate Research and Online Education. We understand that life circumstances can change, and we want to make it as easy as possible for students to re-engage with their studies. Departing UNI grad students who express interest in returning by June 15 can resume coursework as soon as August. They're required to finish their degree within 2 years from their date of readmission, with just one semester extension request allowed. Given money so often is behind a student's inability to complete a degree, UNI also is offering $500 scholarships for returning students. This scholarship aims to alleviate some of the financial burdens associated with resuming higher education, demonstrating UNI's dedication to facilitating the return of graduate students to their academic pursuits, according to a UNI announcement, indicating returning students could continue in the same degree program or explore other academic interests. We want returning students to feel confident in their decision to resume their graduate program at UNI, Huffman said. Our team is committed to providing the guidance and resources necessary for a successful and fulfilling academic journey. With a tripart mission to bolster UNI's graduate programming, attract faculty, and keep those they have through additional supports, and further grow graduate and professional numbers, UNI last month sought region approval for a new faculty tuition reimbursement program. The program would add faculty to the grad student ranks and support the growth of faculty into terminal degrees to serve UNI students at the undergraduate and graduate levels. Some academic programs and departments uniquely struggle to hire faculty with terminal and/or master's degrees, according to the program proposal. These programs and departments typically have applied areas where market demand often means that few people in the field attain the terminal degree, and in some cases, the master's degree. The tuition-covered program, green-lighted by the board, will be available to faculty in disciplines facing distinct challenges in hiring qualified degree holders. Examples include interior design, construction management, applied engineering, nursing and social work, according to UNI spokesman Pete Morris. We are having challenges with all of the above, and a few more, including some business programs, Morris said, although UNI would prefer and give top priority to faculty pursuing a terminal degree at UNI, another Board of Regents university, any of the region's partnering institutions, or other colleges and universities in Iowa, UNI could support degree pursuits outside the state, according to its proposal. Out-of-state programs must be housed in accredited institutions with reputable online graduate programs reviewed and approved by the Cognizant College Dean and Provost. This program is primarily designed to recruit and retain faculty in fields where there is a paucity of candidates with advanced degrees, according to the program description, noting the reimbursed degree must align with the participant's role at UNI. That is, UNI will only support the acquisition of degrees in programs that are viewed by accreditors as improving competencies in the discipline to be taught by the participant. And to clinch a reimbursement, any interested department, program, or discipline must have an active search underway or show the need for an existing faculty member to enhance his or her credentials, primarily for reasons of accreditation. Fundamentally, the justification must focus on the advantage of having the same person teaching the same course, but with an advanced degree, according to UNI. Given the claim that candidates with the advanced degree are difficult to find, the department should be able to provide evidence of this through an examination of recent search pools. For every year of support, the funded faculty member must give 1 year of service to UNI, in addition to the year of service while tuition support is being provided. Funding for each reimbursement must be worked out between the college deans and provost, and any faculty member who doesn't achieve his or her service requirements has to pay UNI back. We see this program serving UNI for the long term, Morris said. In reporting, the administration hasn't put a timeline on the offer. It is likely there will always be programs, new, old, and in the future, where it will be difficult to find candidates. The incentive may be sufficient for us to grow our own faculty or entice external professionals to join UNI as they work on their degree. UNI, as of October, reported a total workforce of 1,559, including 393 tenure, tenure track, and non-tenure track faculty. That is down from a total of 1,807, including 557 faculty a decade ago in 2013, according to a February Board of Regents Human Resources report. To the question of whether any faculty have applied for the newly available tuition coverage program, Morris said negotiations are ongoing with one. We have one prospective faculty in a current search who has been offered this program in order to pursue a graduate degree, he said. Another front page story by Vanessa Miller is St. Luke's set to close 73-year-old lab scientist program. Having already admitted students for the next academic year, Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital about a month ago surprised current and incoming students by announcing plans to close its 73-year-old medical laboratory scientist program. The 43-week program, training new medical laboratory scientists through hands-on clinical training inside St. Luke's laboratories, officially will wrap up at the end of the current school year in August, according to Unity Point Health Cedar Rapids spokeswoman Sarah Carrizo. Students admitted for the 2024-25 academic year beginning in the fall will have to find another MLS program, but Carrizo said there are multiple programs within the area. Allen College in Waterloo, for example, is accredited by the National Accreditation Agency of Clinical Laboratory Services and is willing and able to accommodate St. Luke's students in the next academic year should they apply and meet entrance requirements, according to Carrizo. Plus, students wouldn't need to relocate to the Allen program as it's largely online and clinical rotations can still be conducted within St. Luke's laboratory, as St. Luke's will remain a clinical site for Allen College and other educational institutions. The 6 current students, plus another 6 who months ago were accepted for the next academic year, learned of the program closure February 28 via phone call and letter. This was not an easy decision, Carrizo told the Gazette. The MLS program has been successful in the past, but in recent years has faced multiple obstacles, such as a decrease in enrollment and a decline in the number of students who stay within St. Luke's laboratory after graduating from the program. The program historically has collaborated with multiple universities and colleges across Iowa, including the state's public universities, Cornell College, Wartburg College, and Mount Mercy University. At Cornell, for example, students could get a bachelor's degree and register as a medical technologist by completing 3 years at Cornell and then 1 year at St. Luke's under the supervision of a staff pathologist. The University of Northern Iowa offered the same style of program with St. Luke's, as did Wartburg, which touts collaborations with other campuses as well, like Mercy College of Health Sciences in Des Moines. The MLS program grants 32 credits to students who attend affiliated academic institutions, which can be utilized toward an overall baccalaureate degree at that institution, according to a 2020 brochure for the St. Luke's program. A certificate of completion is awarded to all students who successfully complete the program. Tuition for the St. Luke's program at that time was $6,000, according to the brochure. Hospital officials did not provide updated tuition expenses, given costs can vary depending on the type of program students pursue, and they didn't detail how much the program costs to provide and thus how much St. Luke's might save with its closure. But, Carrizo said, to help affected students who enrolled in St. Luke's program for the 2024-25 term, the hospital has offered to subsidize tuition expenses above its program costs if they choose to enter Allen College's MLS program. Allen College's Medical Laboratory Science undergraduate program offers a Bachelor of Health Science degree for students interested in becoming medical laboratory scientists, who perform tests that analyze blood, urine, tissue, and other body specimens. The ability to relate to people, care about patient outcomes, and display calm and reasoned judgment are essential qualities, according to Allen College's summary of the profession's import. Although medical laboratory scientists seldom have personal contact with patients, they play a major role in disease diagnosis and in monitoring therapy. Up to 70% of all clinical diagnoses stem from lab test results, according to St. Luke's program, which offered courses titled Urinalysis/Body Fluids, Clinical Hematology/Coagulation, and Clinical Microbiology. The National Institutes of Health last year published research focused on consequences of a critical shortage of medical laboratory scientists and medical laboratory technicians to address an increasing demand for laboratory testing. Training program closures, fewer student applicants, and financial decisions have contributed to staffing shortages, according to the study. Lack of visibility, low wages, and perceived lack of opportunities for upward career mobility contribute to challenges in recruiting and retaining qualified individuals and students who are unaware of laboratory medicine careers. Numerous healthcare providers across Iowa have multiple medical lab scientist job openings, including Unity Point Health locations in Cedar Rapids and Des Moines, University of Iowa Healthcare, Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames, and Trinity Health. Turning to the Iowa Today page, Metro Catholic Schools unveil new leadership, this story by Grace King. Xavier Catholic Schools has announced directors of faith, curriculum, early childhood, enrollment, and finances as it endeavors to bring 8 Metro Catholic schools under a single umbrella this summer. Metro Catholic Schools have been operating under the Xavier Catholic Schools brand since 2013, but each school has maintained its own structure of governance and school board over the past decade. As of July 1, the schools will be part of the Xavier Catholic School system with six new directors. Phil Dre will serve as director of Catholicity and will play a pivotal role in guiding the schools in matters of faith formation, collaboration with parents, parishes for sacramental preparation, and integrating Catholic teachings into the schools. Dre is now the assistant professor in religious studies at Mount Mercy University in Cedar Rapids. He also taught theology at Xavier High School for 17 years. Jamie Larson will be the director of curriculum and instruction. She most recently was a school improvement consultant at Grant Wood Area Education Agency. Before that, Larson was principal of LaSalle Catholic Elementary School and a literacy consultant and classroom teacher. Larson will lead efforts to enhance the curriculum in the school system, ensure alignment with academic standards, and support staff in delivering high-quality instruction. Connie Schulte will be the director for early childhood. She has worked at St. Pius Early Learning Center and the Rockwell Collins Child Development Center. Schulte will be responsible for the development, support, and administration of early childhood programming, including the early childhood centers and preschool. Kara Jones will be director of enrollment, having served as the admissions, college, and career coordinator at Xavier High School since 2014. She also was co-college's associate director of admissions. Jones will be responsible for developing and implementing enrollment strategies and tactics to position Xavier Catholic Schools as the education destination for students and families in the area, according to a news release from the school system. Nick Ireland, now communications director at Xavier High, will be the new systems director of communications. He has worked with Xavier and the foundation for 11 years. He attended St. Jude Elementary, Holy Family Middle School, LaSalle High School, and Xavier High School, graduating in 2001. Angie Calhoun, now the controller at Xavier High, will be the school systems controller, overseeing the system's financial operations, ensuring transparency, accountability, and efficiency. She has led Xavier's financial and strategic planning, according to the news release. Earlier this year, Chris McCarville was named president of the Xavier Catholic School System. The system is part of the Archdiocese of Dubuque and includes eight buildings with an enrollment of 2,104 students this school year. Xavier High School for grades 9 through 12 is located at 6300 42nd Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Regis Middle School for grades 6 through 8 is at 735 Prairie Drive Northeast in Cedar Rapids. LaSalle Catholic Middle School for grades 5 through 8, 3700 First Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids. LaSalle Catholic Elementary for grades PK through 4 is at 3700 First Avenue Northwest. St. Joseph Catholic School for grades PK through 8 is located at 1430 14th Street in Marion. All Saints Elementary for grades PK through 5 is at 720 29th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. St. Matthew Elementary for grades PK through 5 is at 2244 First Avenue Northeast in Cedar Rapids. And St. Pius X Elementary for grades PK through 5 is at 4901 Council Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Under the new system, the Regis and LaSalle Catholic Middle Schools eventually will consolidate into a single location. A study is being conducted on possible locations for a 600-student consolidated middle school for 6th through 8th grades. St. Joseph and Marion will remain a preschool through 8th grade building for at least the next 5 years, at which time the system will be reassessed. Also in Iowa Today News, this story by Emily Anderson. A Coralville man who was arrested in April 2022 on charges that he sexually abused a 4-year-old child was found not guilty of all charges by a jury Monday. Jeffrey Dodds, 65, was charged with 3 counts of third-degree sexual abuse after the child reportedly told her grandmother and later investigators that Dodds had touched her inappropriately while she attended daycare in his home, according to a search warrant request filed early in the investigation and made available after the trial ended on Monday. Dodds and his wife, former Coralville City Council member Jill Dodds, owned and operated Simple Abundance Child Care since 1998, according to the center's website, which has been removed from the internet. The facility voluntarily surrendered their license on December 31, 2021. Alex Carfrey, spokesperson of the Iowa Department of Human Services, said after Dodds was arrested. Jill Dodds had resigned from the city council in April of 2022 after Coralville Mayor Megan Foster asked her to resign because of her husband's arrest. And this story on the Nation World page might be of interest. It's an AP story titled, IRS, 940,000 unclaimed tax refunds are about to expire. The IRS is warning taxpayers that they may be leaving more than $1 billion on the table. The federal tax collector said Monday that roughly 940,000 people in the U.S. have until May 17 to submit tax returns for unclaimed refunds for the tax year 2020, which total more than $1 billion nationwide. The average median refund is $932 for 2020. Texas, California, Florida, and New York have the largest number of people potentially eligible for refunds. IRS Commissioner Danny Werfel said in a statement, "We want taxpayers to claim these refunds, but time is running out for people who may have overlooked or forgotten about the refund. There's a May 17 deadline to file these returns, so taxpayers should start soon to make sure they don't miss out." For people who need to file a return, the IRS advises taxpayers to request their W-2, 1098, 1099, or 5498 from their employer or bank, or order a free wage and income transcript using the, quote, Get Transcript Online, end quote, tool at irs.gov. Taxpayers typically have 3 years to file and claim tax refunds. Otherwise, the money becomes the property of the U.S. Treasury. Generally, the deadline to claim old refunds falls around April 15, but this year, the 3-year window for 2020 unfiled returns was postponed to May 17 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Werfel said some people may not realize they may be owed a refund. We encourage people to review their files and start gathering records now so they don't run the risk of missing the May deadline. According to the latest tax season statistics, more than 71.5 million individual tax filings have been submitted to the IRS this season. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column today by Bruce Lear is titled, A Cautionary Tale About a County Jail. There's a whole county in Iowa that's been jailed, and that's in quotes. The Woodbury County Jail construction debacle, spanning 13 years, is riddled with secrecy, mistakes, and lack of supervision, leaving county taxpayers wondering how they'll escape a huge tax burden. It's a cautionary tale for other unsuspecting cities and towns. In 2011, the 24-year-old county jail was starting to crumble. But the wheels of county government grind slowly, and in 2013, supervisors requested estimates to improve the antiquated security system. The estimated cost was $1.2 million for a security update. Then the price tag soared. A lot of other things needed upgrading and retrofitting, so the price increased to about $22 million. Why not build a brand new jail at a new location? And the county could let the federal government pay part of the tab while housing its prisoners. The local construction unions backed the project, believing local workers would get good-paying jobs. But the federal government was changing the sentencing guidelines and reducing jail time, and the only way to afford a $43 million new jail was to pass a large bond issue, raising property taxes. Living in Woodbury County, there's one thing I know. Trying to pass a bond issue with 60% approval is comparable to me winning a marathon. There had to be another way. Instead of trying to pass a bond issue requiring 60%, they decided to use a little-known Iowa law, allowing joint public authorities to issue bonds with a 50% vote from the public. So, Sioux County and Woodbury County created the Woodbury County Jail Authority, and a new governing board was born to oversee construction and own the jail. Labor led the charge, and it passed by a slim margin. But again, those pesky details got in the way. The law limits the bonding authority of joint entities to $50 million. It still worked alone, although the price had risen to $49 million. The $49 million began to soar, with the lowest bid from a company in Lincoln, Nebraska, coming in at $58.4 million. That company completed the responsible contractor questionnaire provided by organized labor to ensure quality construction, but no one checked for accuracy. The company could have been rejected. It wasn't. COVID-19 hit. There were delays in the supply chain, increased prices, multiple change orders, and numerous mistakes. County supervisors voted to use $20 million of COVID relief funds. Loud protests were met with silence. The cost soared to $70 million. The original opening date for the jail was September 14, 2023. Then April 4 was announced. The new goal was mid-May, but many believe July is more realistic. How did this happen? There was a thick veil of secrecy. The jail authority wouldn't allow the public or press near the project without a 10-hour safety training course and permission from the sheriff. No filming or photos was allowed. It was a public project without public scrutiny. It's a cautionary tale for other counties who want to escape being jailed. And again, that's by Bruce Lear, who lives in Sioux City, taught for 11 years in public schools, and represented educators as an Iowa State Education Association regional director for 24 years until retiring. He can be reached at brucelear2419@gmail.com. We have one community letter today, and that is titled, "Potch Huckabee Should Stop Fearmongering." In the Friday, March 15 Gazette, Iowa's congressional campaigns were covered. Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor and presidential candidate, endorsed Iowa 1st District congressional candidate David Potch. Huckabee said in his endorsement that Potch could, quote, help save America from the oppression that has destroyed our constitutional liberties, national security, economy, schools, law and order, small businesses, and families, end quote. Dear God, please just stop. Where in the world does Mike Huckabee live? Where in America is life that bleak? What cave has he been living in, and what dark information sources is he following that only the oppression that has destroyed us is the experience you are having? These two men have a pulpit, one of them literally, so they should please use their position and their pulpit to celebrate some of our country's successes, ideals, and values, even though we haven't realized all of them fully. At the very least, they should go for a walk down any Iowa sidewalk in any Iowa town and celebrate our freedoms, our diverse people, and the beautiful places in our country. But please, for God's sake, for the sake of America, use your pulpits differently. Fear is not an answer to America's issues. Please, just stop. And that letter today is signed by Matt Tapscott from Decorah. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, March 26th on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First in Belle Plaine, Robert Wayne Hupfeld, age 86, died Sunday, March 24. Phillips Funeral Home, Keystone. In Clarence, Kevin Jeffery, age 87, died Tuesday, March 12. Chapman Funeral Home is in charge. In Clarence, Robert Miller, age 93, died Monday, March 25th. Chapman Funeral Home is assisting. In Marion, Jacqueline Hauser, age 84, died Monday, March 25. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. And in Washington, Kenneth Yoder, 22, died Friday, March 22nd. Yoder Powell Funeral Home, Kelowna. Turning now to the regular notices, we begin with St. Louis, Missouri. Juanita Zumbrunnen died from breast cancer on Monday, February 19th at the Del Mar Garden South Nursing Home in St. Louis, Missouri. She was 90 years old. Juanita was born on November 18, 1933 to Frederick and Ella Eltz Zumbrunnen. She grew up on a farm near Coggin, Iowa, with her sisters Arlene and Jerry and her brother Glenn, and graduated from Coggin High School. At the age of 17, Juanita married Ronald Curley of Ryan, Iowa. Their 13-year marriage, which ended in divorce, resulted in two children. Juanita then married Alfred Anderson of St. Louis, Missouri, and they later divorced. At the age of 30, Juanita began her many years of higher education at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. She graduated with a Bachelor of Arts degree in 1965, and in 1971 received a Master of Arts degree in American and Russian Literature from Mills College in Oakland, California. She was awarded a Ph.D. in American and Russian Literature from the University of Iowa in 1986. In Manchester, Patricia Ann, known as Pat Graybill, age 84, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away Sunday, March 24, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester with family by her side after a two-year battle with cancer. A celebration with burial at Oakland Cemetery will be held at a later date. Bonenkamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester is assisting the family. Pat was born on November 26, 1939, the daughter of W.R., known as Duke, and Fern Gaffney Hamblin in Manchester. She graduated from Manchester High School in 1958. After graduation, Pat worked at Wallace's Inc., where she met Jim, and they later married in 1960. She also worked for Farm Bureau Insurance, Dr. Krieger in Optometry, accounting for various family-owned businesses, and was the kitchen supervisor for West Delaware Middle School until her retirement. Please share a memory of Pat at murdochfuneralhome.com. And in lieu of flowers, memorials in her memory are suggested to the Care Initiative Hospice, 910 West Main Street in Manchester, Iowa, 52057. In Sigourney, Glenda O'Connus, 87, died March 18 in Ottumwa, Iowa. She was born September 25, 1936, to Glenn and Veda Bissell Harlan in Marshalltown, Iowa. She graduated from Santa Monica High School. On September 4, 1954, she married Lee O'Connus in Southern California. And they lived in California in 1962 and then moved to the Cedar Rapids area. Funeral services will be at 6 p.m. Thursday, March 28th at the Home Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, March 28th at the Funeral Home. Burial will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, March 29th at Cedar Memorial Cemetery, Garden of the Last Supper in Cedar Rapids. Arrangements are with the Home Funeral Home. In Bettendorf, Jeremy Brophy, age 86, passed away March 23rd at Trinity Medical Center in Bettendorf. Per his wishes, Jerry will be cremated with no funeral services. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Jerry was born to William and Hilda Weigand Brophy, May 28, 1937, in Fergus Falls, Minnesota. Following his graduation from Luther College, Jerry moved to Cedar Rapids for a position at United Fire and Casualty. Jerry was united in marriage with Karen Don of Wheatland, Iowa, May 1, 1960. Following Karen's death, he met and married Carol Palmquist of Ames, Iowa, on October 9, 1993. Jerry was a truck driver for Hubbard Milling and Nash Finch until he retired in 1996. Memorial contributions are suggested in his name to Luther College's General Scholarship Fund. In Cedar Rapids, Desi M. Allens, age 91, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died March 11 in Boise, Idaho. Graveside services are at 10 a.m. Thursday, March 28th at Linwood Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting the family. Desi was born March 27, 1932, in St. Louis, Missouri, the daughter of George and Mary Calagoras Mavromatis. She attended Shenandoah Grade School, graduated from Roosevelt High School, and was united in marriage to James Allens for over 50 years. The couple married in St. Louis, Missouri, and she worked at A.C. Nielsen and Cashion Brothers, Inc. Desi moved to Boise to be near her daughter, Francine. Memorials are suggested to St. George Antiochian Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. Please share a memory of her at murdochfuneralhome.com. And our final obituary today from Cedar Rapids, Blake Michael Wilson, passed away Wednesday, March 20 at the age of 45. A celebration of life will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 27th at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel Stateroom. Sharing memories will begin at 6:30. There will be no service. Blake was born on July 17, 1978, to William and Colleen Wilson in Cedar Rapids. He graduated from Marion High School in 1997 and earned a degree in Computer Information Systems at Kaplan University in 2009. Blake was a network engineer at UFG Insurance. Memorial suggestions are to Blake's family. Online condolences can be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. Turning now to the sports page, this boys' tennis story is by Mike Condon, and the title, Linmar Coach Elated with New Facility. For nearly 20 years, Chris Wundrum has consistently had the Linmar's boys' tennis team among the best in the state. The Lions have made the state tournament in every season but one since 2012, winning state titles in 2015 and 2018. Now Linmar will have a state-of-the-art facility to showcase its program. An 8-court complex located adjacent to the existing baseball and softball facilities at Oak Ridge Middle School was completed during the current school year and was available when the team began practice earlier this month. It was a surreal feeling for all of us that first practice, Wundrum said. I think everyone is beyond elated with how the courts turned out. I texted Linmar Activities Director Tanya Moe a couple times before the season started when I was at the new courts getting ready, saying it really didn't seem real. A ribbon cutting for the facility will be held on April 2nd at 3:30 p.m., prior to the Lions' season-opening match against West Des Moines Valley. We are just excited to be able to provide our tennis programs and the community new courts, Moe said, and that we have a district that supports those needs. The Lions' old courts, located at the high school campus, served well for years, but one of the problems was an overall lack of space, especially for those watching the matches. Those issues were addressed in the design of the new complex. We wanted to make sure our new facility was spectator-friendly, which we definitely achieved, Wundrum said. The design of having 8 courts in groups of 2 allows spectators and coaches to view all 8 courts by just turning their head. It's really impressive how everything came together. Wundrum was able to provide input on the new facility, which will have lights on 4 of the 8 courts. It was a collaboration of things we liked from different facilities across the state, he said. My personal input was just the experience of being a coach for a long time now and making some suggestions from different things I've seen at facilities over the years. The boys and girls programs at Linmar have more than 60 athletes out. Wundrum said the new facility allows for much more flexibility for both teams. 8 courts and lights makes a significant difference, especially for practice, he said. Having 2 additional courts, along with lights on 4 courts, allows more opportunities both for court space and practicing hours. Wundrum's first team at the new facility should be another strong one. Malcolm Rice finished 5th at state in Class 2A doubles last year, and the graduated Zach Mersch, while Garrett Bauermeister, and Jackson Kramer were seventh. "We have really good depth on this year's team," Wondrum said. "We've been to state six consecutive seasons and won state twice in the past eight. I could argue this might be our deepest team of them all." Going Green is the title of this article about girls' soccer, and it's by Ryan Plegenkuhl. For the Marion girls' soccer team, green isn't just a color, it's a contract. A tradition Marion coach Eric Trilk instituted 6 or 7 years ago. Each season begins with every member of the program signing a soccer ball in green ink, symbolizing a commitment to unity and always putting forth maximum effort. The team also wears green wristbands during games, and everyone gets a green t-shirt. It's all part of what the Wolves call their Go Green tradition. "Our team is like a family, so to us it's really important to support one another. And one of the best ways to do that is by always giving our all," sophomore Maggie Unzinger said. "A team doesn't work well together if one person is giving 90% and another giving just 10%. So signing our green ball is a contract to always do our best." Marion's green ball doesn't sit idly once signed. It goes where the team goes as a constant reminder of the mission. It comes out to practice with us, and it sits in the mud and the rain. Sometimes we even kick it around if we're a ball short, Trickle said. It travels with us. It's in every huddle we bring in. The 2023 Wolves reached the state tournament for the first time in program history, meaning last year's ball holds significant value to returning players. "This year when I was cleaning, we were getting air pumped into all the balls, and there was last year's green ball that we took to state, so faded and worn," Trickle said. "I tossed it to Caitlin Allison and then said, 'Look, this is the one ball that has ever been to state,'" she said. "Well, let's sign another ball and get it there." That's their mentality. They're hungry. To return to Crown East Soccer Park in Des Moines, Marion will have to make up for the departure of 15 seniors. Fortunately, the team's top three goal scorers from last season, Utzinger, Hill Dale, and Amory Hall, all return. "We're very excited about this year. It's become very evident in practices so far that we're really bringing back a lot, and especially really good teammates." While experience returns on offense, there will be a change of guard at goalkeeper. "We lost a really good one last year, Ashlyn Hall, and we have a ninth grader, Josie Logan, who will be our starting varsity keeper this year," Trickle said. "She's incredible and has the ability to be really special. That was the one really big hole that we were very concerned about, and we are no longer concerned." The Wolves will need to bring their A game throughout Wamac Conference play in what should be a hotly contested East division. Independence finished last season ranked number 5 in 2A, while Centerpoint, Urbana, Solon, and Mount Vernon all had records of 0.5 or better. With the reshuffling of the Wamac, I don't think anyone would deny our side of the conference is more difficult, Coach said. "Our girls are very determined to prove that they can be the ones that finish on top." So, what's the key to getting this year's green ball to Des Moines? Staying true to tradition. If we are having a tough game, just having the green on our wrists reminds us to keep trying, Utzinger said. "I think if we keep the work up and stay as close as we are now, we are bound to have the good season I'm hoping for." Marion's season starts at home on Thursday against Cedar Rapids Jefferson. In boys tennis, here are the teams to watch for 2024. Iowa City West, the Trojans will be in search of their third straight Class 2A state title. Coach Marshall Mollers will need to rely on some new faces this season, losing three seniors from a team that downed Waukee Northwest for the 2023 crown. Cedar Rapids Washington, Coach Tom Neff's team qualified for the 2A state meet last year and returns a number of players from that unit, including seniors Colton Eilers, Thor White, and Logan Sherman, juniors Luke Burkamper and Brock Davis, along with sophomore Bjorn White. "Obviously, I like our depth," Neff said. "We are very even and balanced this year." Cedar Rapids Xavier, it appears the Saints could be in line for a fifth straight 1A state team title. Coach Jim Potts returns 5 of 7 players from last year's team and is adding a talented freshman in Bennett Link. Sophomore Charlie LeGrand was the 1A singles runner-up last year, while Jacob Schmidt and Garrett Muir combined for a fifth-place doubles finish. From Decorah, Matt Anderson returns, Class 1A state singles champion Caden Branham to lead the way. Also back are seniors Seth Bolson, Gabriel Heiner, Aiden Nalen Carlson, along with junior Liam Chamberlain for a team that finished 4th in Class 1A. The Vikings will be in search of a 6th straight conference championship. We bring back a strong team after losing our 2 and 3 players who finished runner-up in doubles last year, coach said. From Linmar, the Lions once again are likely to be in the mix for 2A team honors under veteran coach Chris Wundrum. Linmar finished 4th in Class 2A last season and returns 3 players, seniors Jackson Kramer and Malcolm Rice, along with sophomore Garrett Bauermeister, who all placed in the top 8 in the state doubles tournament last season. In sports of area interest today, in high school track, Regina is at the Tipton Invitational. In boys soccer, Marion is at Xavier at 7 p.m. Regina is at Solon at 5:30 p.m. In girls soccer, Jefferson is at Western Dubuque at 5:15. Turning now to the Things to Do column, in the literary category, join Swamp Fox Bookstore and the Marion Public Library to celebrate the release of Everyone is Watching by Iowa author Heather Gudenkauf in conversation with author Laura McHugh. That takes place at the Marion Public Library from 6 to 7 p.m. today, and that is free. In the music category, Key Change Series No. 6, presented by Orchestra Iowa and the University of Iowa School of Music, the series is dedicated to providing performing artists a live performance. That takes place at the Opus Concert Cafe, 119 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids, from 6 to 7:30 p.m., and a $10 donation is suggested. In the literary category, An Evening with David Markward, intertwining personal growth with significant historical events and figures, David Markward's memoir, From Dubuque to Selma and Beyond, delves into the heart of America's racial divides. Through thought-provoking questions at the start of each chapter, the former Cedar Rapids superintendent challenges readers to assess their own understanding of racism. That takes place at the Parlor City Pub and Eatery, 1125 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, 6:30 to 8 p.m. this evening, and that is free. And see the solar eclipse April 8th at Eastern Iowa Observatory, this by Tom Weber. Don your solar-approved glasses on April 8th when the Earth, Moon, and Sun do a rare dance across the United States in the form of a solar eclipse. Cedar Rapids will see a partial eclipse, while other areas of the country will see a total eclipse. The eclipse start time in Cedar Rapids is 12:46 p.m. Maximum coverage of 85% will be reached at 2:01 p.m. The eclipse will end at 3:16. The nearest point to Cedar Rapids to view totality is about 300 miles away in southern Illinois or Indiana. The total eclipse portion is tantalizingly brief, depending on how close you are to the center line of the path of the shadow. Totality, or the moment when the moon's shadow completely covers the sun, will last 2 to 4 minutes. The total eclipse will begin in the South Pacific and move through Mexico, the U.S., and Canada before ending in the North Atlantic. In the United States, it will enter Texas at about 12:30 p.m., move across 14 states, and exit through Maine at 3:30 Eastern Time. The width of the moon's shadow covering the sun will be more than 100 miles wide, and the entire event is about 2.5 hours from the moment the moon first appears to touch the sun's edge through totality to when it finally leaves the sun's sphere. April's eclipse will be the first total eclipse in the United States since 2017, and we won't see another in the lower 48 states until 2044, when a few Montana and North Dakota residents will be treated to the sight. In 2045, an annular eclipse will sweep across the lower half of the country from California to Florida. If you go, partial solar eclipse celebration will take place at the Eastern Iowa Observatory and Learning Center from 12:30 to 3:15 on April 8. It is free, and they will provide free solar glasses. Solar telescopes will be trained on the sun. If you plan to look at the sun, it is important to wear approved solar glasses. Regular sunglasses do not protect your eyes from ultraviolet light. Looking at the sun, even for a short time, can do irreversible damage to your eyes, so don't take any chances. Solar sunglasses are available at many outlets around the area for a modest price. Finishing up with a brief look at the weather, rain and snow likely today, with wind out of the west from 20 to 30 miles an hour, gusting higher. Cedar Rapids looking for a high of 46 degrees and a low of 24. The normal high for today is 52 and the normal low is 31. We set a record high of 85 degrees in 1907 and a record low of 5 degrees in 1955. Mostly sunny continues through the rest of the week. Sunset tonight is at 7:26 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 6:57 a.m. That gives us 12 hours and 27 minutes of daylight. We are in the full moon phase with moonrise at 9:04 p.m. and set at 7:51 a.m. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, March 26th, 2024. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online on iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.